Hello, this is The Lake Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel #LinuxShow. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
And we're back.
That's The Lake Show for December the 2nd, 2003, I think. Boy, December. Man, the year has just flown by. Amazing. We actually had snow on the ground this weekend. So the winter has definitely started here in the Chicago area. I had my hot tub turned off for a couple of hours over the weekend, and a little skim of ice sort of formed over the top of the hot tub, so it was a little bit scary when I got home from visiting folks, getting the heater kick-started on my hot tub because of the cold spell that we had over the weekend. But then on Monday, what was it, Kevin? 65 degrees on Monday? So
no, Monday was cold. Sunday.
Well, it was Sunday that was...
Sunday was nice. Yeah. I had my motorcycle out.
It went like 30 degrees down and then 30 degrees back up all in about a 30-hour period. So
wow.
Typical Chicago weather. A great example of, if you don't like it, just wait till tomorrow because it'll be completely different. But let's go ahead and get the show kicked off for tonight and bring in the panel. Everybody's already connected up. How are you doing tonight, Russ?
Oh, hanging in here inside the suddenly cold Washington, D.C. area. I think that this year we've been hit with more winds in the last month than I think than I can ever recall inside the 15-odd years I've been out here. It's absolutely incredible. But winter has definitely arrived here.
Yeah, well, wind's something that we deal with on a daily basis around here. All the farm land around us, that wind gets kicking up over the prairies, and there's nothing stopping it until it slams into Chicago. So,
well, in D.C. we have a different problem. We have tons of hot air which comes out of a major metropolitan area near us that no one can seem to stop either, but it doesn't seem to result in those sorts of winds normally.
I thought they built walls around that hot air, though.
No. That doesn't work that way. the walls, you know, they've been trying to break down those walls for years, and wind just comes right through.
It's like a nuclear containment device, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stick them in a building. So, well, how are you doing tonight, Arnie?
Oh, doing fine. It's a beautiful day today in Southern California, and it was cold this morning, and it went up. Close to 40 to 50 degrees change in temperature today, and got over 70.
Wow! So you had ice?
It was pretty cold. Probably 40 this morning, which is cold for here.
Yeah, it was 23 degrees here this morning.
Yeah, that's cold. When you get below 20, it's cold.
Yeah. Well. And how are things with you, Doc?
They're fine now. I went up to visit with relatives in the Bay Area over Thanksgiving and had a really great time up there. I took three young boys to the Monterey Bay Aquarium. It was a lot of fun and more fun than I expected it to be, because I thought that many guys, you know, age 10, 7, and 6 would be an unstable compound, but they were actually pretty fun. And but then on Sunday I got real sick, and my kid had some kind of crud a week before, and then my wife's got it today. So this thing's been running through the family, so I was delayed driving out of there, and we drove back down yesterday morning. I'm just starting to come out of it. And as always, since we're talking about the weather, it was rainy up there and really miserable, and when we got down here, of course, it was clear and sunny and beautiful. So that's life in the South Lane.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be beautiful in Santa Barbara.
It's supposed to be.
That's like why it's like one of the most expensive places on the planet.
That's one of them. Also the fact that, you know, too many Hollywood types who haven't experienced a recession yet will pay too much for houses here. I think the dot-com thing happened and never stopped. So, but that's okay because we have a house to sell pretty soon. So we're hoping we'll get to come out ahead on that one. So
property values down here just going through the ceiling. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, every 2 years, Alice and I refinance a house and end up paying off a lot more bills and stuff along the way. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Property values just going up, 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 up.
Hello, everybody.
Well, Eric Raymond.
Hey, dude.
It's good to hear you tonight.
Has the show started?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like it.
Yes.
Well, now it has.
You're talking about house prices on the Linux show?
Yeah,
how did that happen?
We're talking about stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Doc, well, we know what the cool thing you did over Thanksgiving. Anybody else do anything totally unique for Thanksgiving this year?
No, we just went down to the in-laws. Hmm.
I went to a wine party on Thanksgiving afternoon, and have determined that in the future that is something that I am going to avoid.
not enough Republicans or what?
No. It's just that a wide assortment, and let's put it this way, a generous volume of a wide assortment of different kinds of wine, and then top that with turkey and pumpkin pie is not a good mix in one day.
Oh, yeah.
And it made for a pretty miserable Friday. I pretty much spent most of the day, consuming antacids and other stomach remedies for self-disabilitating things that I did that day. So I don't think I'm ever going to go to a wine party on Thanksgiving Day again, that's for sure. But let's go ahead and jump into the news segment. And Doc, I know you sent in a bunch of things. Some of the stuff was repeats of your Linux lunacy, but what have you got new for us this week?
Well, it's not something that's published. It's something that I want to publish. And so there are no direct links to this, but something I'm working on for Linux Journal right now is a study of how Linux and open source are being used in the political campaigns, and I desperately need Republicans here. I mean, I've got Democrats out the yin yang, and that's a fine thing, but I mean, I got lots of friends in the Clark campaign and the Dean campaign and so forth. And I heard from one guy after I put something in, after the piece I worked least on of any piece I've ever worked on in Linux Journal. I think it took about 8 minutes. I went to Netcraft and just did a lookup of you know, what kind of servers Netcraft thought the various campaigns were using, and plus the Democratic and the Republican National Committees, and found out the Republican National Committee was using Windows and had to restart every 2 days, and the Democratic Committee used Linux and hadn't restarted in a year and a half or something like that. But anyway, and of course it got slash-dotted and had a whole lot of activity, most of it meaningless, on that particular item. But this one guy wrote to me, and he worked with Republicans, he said, and he worked with the Bush campaign, and they had Linux behind the scenes, and the only thing they were doing that was at all not Linux was just this damn Bush site, campaign site, but everything else was all Linux. They said, great, talk to me, and then never heard from him again. So I want to send an appeal out to listeners.
You're supposed to be contacted by somebody from...
I know you're telling me this, but I need people to come through with the goods here.
Maybe you're just too scary, Doc.
Once again, I guess. The problem, of course, is that Bush is running unopposed, and so there's not a lot of, you know, I mean, it's just not, I mean, on the Democratic side, there's just a lot of guys going at each other, and that, of course, creates a whole lot of sites and a whole lot of satellite sites and so forth and so on. Whereas on the Republican side, it appears to be a done deal. Nonetheless, anybody. That isn't the only race that's going to happen, and there have to be many others, and I'm just hoping somebody will come through with some stuff. So
there's going to be like a whole lot of house races and...
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
house races and 435
of them.
Races and,
so there ought to be plenty of sites to analyze.
Yeah, yeah. So
that sounds like a fun project.
Nonpartisan. I mean, Meetup runs on Linux, and it's not a partisan thing. But nonetheless, that's something that's involved in politics and various candidates can use. But I'm looking for new stuff here because I think it's going to be. I think it's going to be an interesting story. So just looking for any help I can get with that. And that's, so basically I just want to use my, 4 minutes to plug that once again.
Well, I'll see what I can do about getting the guy from the White House to follow through. And
that'd be great. That'd be great.
Yeah. Okay, Russ, you got a few stories for us.
Yeah, I got a few. There's also a quick one that I didn't get in, and frankly, the text of this, anytime I've ever seen it, it's like two paragraphs. But if you go to Google, to Google News, and plunk in Novel Zimian, India, you'll find it. And that is just this little blurb that I ran across that says that since Novel purchased Zimian, they've hired 40 software programmers in India to improve the Zimian product line.
I spoke at some length with Nat Friedman about that. Several months ago. For some reason, I didn't know that was news. But I guess so.
Well, it just seems to be making the rounds now, as far as I can tell, because there have been a number of pieces about it, just mentioning it here in the last few days.
Yeah, I saw that one, too. Yeah.
But
it's interesting that they, this is a kind of a worrisome thing in the tech industry, is the offshore, hiring offshore a lot, and companies based here rehiring offshore instead of hiring here. It's a problem.
Yeah, although it's kind of an interesting thing, I mean, for me particularly, because I've worked with companies that have done a lot of this in the past, and the open source movement is an international movement, so inside, and one level it makes perfect sense that it would have international participation. It certainly doesn't change the base of things. But from a U.S.-centric economic point of view, this has been a standard tactic now for over 10 years inside the industry, and it's, even coming in now with companies that are dealing with open source.
I get the feeling that this is not a move to increase international cultural diversity, though.
No.
I think this is a strictly bottom-line deal.
Tend to believe that's true. I've worked on projects years ago that were heavily staffed by Indian programmers and so forth for the late great Digital Equipment Corporation. So this has been going around for a while.
This is not new news at all. I've done a number of development projects over the years with split crews in various locations around the world. So it's inevitability. As Arnie said, this is a strictly a bottom line issue.
Yep.
And as economies find their water level, the job disbursement will also seek a specific water level. But time will tell as to how much of an impact that really will have on the American economy long term. I always go back to say the same thing when people say stuff like this in terms of fearing that it's going to be disastrous to the economy. But the one thing so far other economies have not been able to duplicate is the entrepreneurial nature of the American economy. Some countries do it on a small scale, but no country in the world comes close to doing the level of entrepreneurism that happens in this country, and that's what keeps middle-level people employed here in this country, is entrepreneurism, more than anything else. And so we'll see what happens in the long term. Any more stories, Russ?
Yeah, a few quickies. Most of them are actually having to do with various projects out there. There's a nice little piece over at NewsForge talking about the Adios Boot CD, which includes some interesting little doohickeys that make it a little bit different from a lot of Linux self-sufficient Linux CDs. One is that it actually has the NSA, or the ability to run the NSA style kernel. It also has the Linux intrusion detection system optional to turn on if you want. There's a number of other things that if you read the article are just quite interesting. They've gone and done something a little bit different than what I've seen with most standalone boot CDs. It looks like an interesting little project.
This is an up-and-coming kind of Linux. Morphix is doing just tremendous. They got I recently BitTorrented four different versions from the Morphix site, and there, I'll tell you right now, for a while I was using that little Linux BBC, business card computer, BCC, whatever, business card CD that Linux Care came out with a few years ago. And I'm now switched to the Morphix Lite GUI for an emergency boot CD that I carry around with me. And it's on a mini CD, and that is a nice little system. It's fast and light and nimble, and it's got everything a guy would want to boot on to get access to his home system from remote. It's really nice. And then of course there's Napix and Dynabolic.
Right. So there's a lot of interesting things going on out there as far as those go.
Yeah, these boot CDs are kind of cool. I mean, it allows you to try things out and quickly.
Yeah.
I think another interesting use for them is rescue disks.
That's what I use this Lite GUI Morphix for. I mean, among other things, is rescue disk. It's also very good for remote access because it's got secure shell and all the stuff you need for that, and VNC, and kind of cool.
Then, let's see, over at Linux, Linmag AU, out there in Australia, I assume, there's an interesting little preview of Xine, X-I-N-E, version 1. It's a program, of course, I've been using for a long time, but it's an interesting little discussion with many of the developers involved as to why they've done the things they've done and what they're doing with it. So I think it's an interesting little piece.
And just to refresh those people, what Xine is, things you built one already. What does it do?
It basically, it's a media player, but it allows you to play DVDs, it allows you to play video streams, all sorts of interesting stuff. But it's very good for anything that has to do with trying to play media of some sort. And it's come a long, long way in the last couple of years.
It's a very, very fairly stable system. One thing that Xine doesn't do is they do not support the encrypted DVDs directly, but it's not too hard to get a library to support that.
Right.
Livenet.org.
Huh?
Livenet.org. That's the site.
They don't point
to it. L-I-V-N-A. They don't point to it directly from the Xine site because they're afraid of DMCA prosecution, but that's where you go.
Well, I mean, you can get the same thing on the M Player site directly on their site, but then again, M Player isn't hosted in the United States.
So there's that end of it. But it's an interesting interview to take a look at.
Yep.
And the last little quickie thing is kind of a goofball kind of a thing, but it's neat. It's talking about memory glasses. It's at indiestar.com, also on the Linux Show homepage. Talking about a developer who had a real problem, and that was trying to remember when to do things and so forth. And so as they've been playing with these wearable computers, he came up with this notion of of basically glasses that would remind you to do certain things at certain points in time. So it's just something that's being goofed around with. It's based on Linux, but it's just one of those neat little strange projects that may, you know, may end up changing the world someday.
Yeah, absolutely. This is no joke, because some people have problems with certain things when you get, you know, preoccupied. I'm very absent-minded, and I can be at, you know, parties and completely forget that I'm supposed to be somewhere else and look up and discover that I'm 3 or 4 hours late. And the real biggie that they talk about in the Memory Glasses article is dealing with remembering people's names and their, you know, getting the names and faces together when you're in a large crowd. I was just to give you an idea of what lengths companies will go to solve this problem, and why this is such a great idea, is what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of executives, when they're at big social gatherings, they walk around these social gatherings with a little device called an in-ear. And in-ear is a, you know, it's a little plug that sticks in your ear, and a wire runs down the inside of your shirt and goes to a little radio receiver that clips to your belt. And it's, you know, very, you know, very tiny. You can't see it's there. And somebody can talk to you very discreetly while you're navigating your way around a large crowd. And what a lot of companies will do is have a prompter sitting on a microphone somewhere, and as an executive is walking up to somebody, the prompter will give the executive the name of the person that they're walking up to. And this product has serious potential. It really does. I could use it myself, that's for sure. So although right now it's sort of like in the very, very early stages, Russ, I agree with you. This is something that could really change life.
Yeah, there's a guy at University of Toronto, I think it's University of Toronto, that has been doing the research, that was one of the forefront researchers in this kind of stuff and the wearable computer thing, and they've been playing around with this stuff for quite some time, and I've played around with some of the software to some extent, and a guy named Randy Rhodes at MIT had a thing called a remembrance agent, and if you scan for that on Google, you might find the source code for that if you want to play around with it. It runs under Emacs, but it's the software that would probably be the precursor for this type of technology. It's kind of interesting too.
Yep. Before we go,
Steve
on
Mann, the... that's the guy.
Yep.
Thank you, Marcel.
Before we go into any more stories, I'd like to go ahead and jump on over to Eric. So there's a couple stories that are on our website. One is from the Always On publication. It's an interview with Bill Gates, Bill Gates on Linux, and his commenting about how expensive it is to deploy Linux. And I just went ahead and put a link to another article that I had found that was the interview of Todd Bishop of the Seattle Post, I think, and interviewing Eric on Microsoft. So I thought it was a good pair of articles to put side by side, Gates on Linux and then Raymond on Microsoft. So, Eric, let's talk about your commentary in this Seattle Post.
I don't even remember that interview. What did I say?
Don't?
What?
You don't even remember it?
Yes. When was this?
It's one of those I was overheard to have said moments.
It was posted December 1st. So
oh.
I would think it was in the last couple of weeks.
Very likely.
But you don't even remember it, huh?
I don't remember a thing.
It's a great interview.
Well, the guy interviewing you, his name is Brent Thill. Prudential Security.
Oh, that. No. Okay, that has nothing to do with any newspaper in Seattle.
It was published in
Seattle. Oh, okay. I know all about this. Okay, this is actually a transcript of a conference call I did with a bunch of Prudential Securities investors. It's not actually a journalistic interview at all. What happened was Prudential wanted me to talk to a bunch of their big money investors, and they got me on the phone, and I took questions and talked for a while. And the interview went really well, well enough that I corrected the transcript for them, and then made sure I could publish it. And I published it on my website. And what must have happened is this guy in Seattle must have picked it up off my website and published it.
Yeah, I think that's what happened.
That's exactly what happened. I'm clicking through to your website from it right now.
Yep.
So what did you want to know about it?
Really was using it as a comparison piece between the two, and I tell you what, rather than me repeating your own words back to you, let me give you some of the assertions of Bill Gates and let you respond to his comments.
Okay.
Okay, because that's probably going to be more directly entertaining.
Yes.
The first major threat, let's talk about, is security. Bill Gates says that if you look at security, in theory, security is supposedly better in Unix and Linux. This is a misleading illusion because of the larger number of users that make use of Microsoft, the speed of propagation because of the popularity of Microsoft, the speed of propagation is therefore also faster than with Unix and Linux.
Ah, now that one's easy to refute. If the number of security cracks in an operating system were simply a function of the number of systems deployed out there, then there would be many, many more Apache website defacements than IIS defacements, because Apache's running two-thirds of the world's websites right now. And if it was a simple function of exposure, then you would see if the proportion were just driven by the number of systems out there, you'd see a lot more Apache cracks than IIS. Now, in fact, that's not what you see. You see a lot more defacements and cracks on IIS sites than you do on Apache sites, and that demonstrates that what drives the number of security cracks isn't exposure, but the fundamental vulnerability of the system.
Okay. What about malicious intent?
There you go.
A lot more people simply hate Windows. I mean, if you're widely seen as the bad guy in the world, people are more motivated, wouldn't they be?
Well, but why aren't those people?
Why aren't they hacking System 5?
That's an interesting question. Could there be more people? I suppose.
I mean, it's hard to run a controlled study, but it just seems to me that, you know, there's more sport in cracking the monopolists.
Now there, I think you got it backwards.
But
since everybody knows that Windows systems are easy to crack, the really sporting thing would be to crack the stuff that's difficult.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, and also, Doc, you got to take into consideration the fact that. Let's put it this way, on an analogy level, if Bill Gates is Emperor Palpatine, then Darl is Darl Vader.
How did SEO get in this story?
Yeah, but Darl isn't. He just wishes he was.
Yeah, I know,
I can't resist this. One of my wife's old business partner's favorite lines is about the flea floating down a river on his back with a hard on yelling, "Raise the bridge." Okay, so it's in that spirit that Darl wants to be Darth. Okay, so you know, it's whereas the, you know, a lot of people are taking the bridge, you know, the Windows bridge, as it were, and they'd like to blow that damn bridge up. You know, so to stretch that metaphor about as far as it can go, I was thinking just simply of the men's room wall thing, and which is, you know, people will say something sucks and they'll write it on the wall. And people just want to put graffiti on IIS and just say it sucks. Maybe because it is easy. You know, you get graffiti where you can have it. You know, I mean, it's, you don't get graffiti inside the Washington Monument. You know, you're going to get it down by the railroad. Right?
Yeah, well but you just, where you
but
get graffiti
actually,
where you can have it just makes my point
though,
for
it?
Me.
Huh? What's that?
When you said you get graffiti where you can have it, you just made the point.
Exactly, I just made your first point. Exactly, yeah.
Oh, well, okay, I've got one other question. The other general theme that was in this particular rhetoric by Gates is starting to become fairly common in the things I've been reading of late, you know, of the last 2, 3, 4 weeks that have come out of either Gates or Ballmer. And that's their focus on using the argument that Microsoft, as a deployment choice, will have a total cost of ownership simply because of that in the long run, if you take one, one unified architecture across the entire computing environment, well, that's going to be cheaper from the company's standpoint. Well, you know,
they've been playing that tune for years.
Yeah, they have been playing that tune for years. And the surprising thing about it is, you know, they know that the enterprise people are sitting there going, who are you trying to fool?
A quick show of hands.
There is no such thing as one unified architecture anymore. That argument is gone. And so my question then in this article, or my questions to you about this article, is why are they continuing to resurrect this particular argument when they know that this is a dead horse that they're flogging?
Well, you know, it may not be as dead as we like to think it is, for the simple reason that there's an article over at processor.com, where I do write on occasion, from someone else talking about the faults of open source, and they beat this dead horse there too. That that diversity is expensive. Therefore, and in this particular article, they talk about in small to medium businesses, it makes sense to have uniformity to save money. And so that's one of the knocks that they have against open source.
One of the ancillary arguments to that one is that choice is bad. We hate choice. Oh no, choice is bad.
Yeah, but, you know, it absolutely amazes me. In fact, if anyone wants to go over and take a look at this article, it takes a little bit to find under processor.com opinions, and I think it was published about 3 days ago. But it really kind of alarmed me in that it's going through lines of FUD that I thought we'd gotten rid of about
two and a half years ago. Yeah, years ago.
Yeah, and it's, you know, what goes around comes around, it's all coming back again. So it seems to me like I'm going to have to start going over the old concepts again, because obviously some people don't get it. But one of the things that I've come to realize, though, inside my own dealings in the last couple of years, is that the audience keeps changing. You know, we talked to the early adopters, and they got it. Then we started to talk to the beginning of the major wave, and they got it. But now we're starting to get, a group of people looking at it that have held off. And so they've got all the old messages rattling around through their brains, and we have to debunk them all over again.
Walt Disney just re-releasing some of their old pre-1950 cartoons again and for the big screen, and they do that every once in a while because the whole generation of people who haven't seen them again. Eric, it's time for you to re-release the Cathedral and the Bazaar again. I mean, just you know, as it's originally was published, so that we can have a whole new generation of people understand open source.
it never went away. It's been on the
I
website continuously.
You're gonna have to rewrite it as a rap.
Yeah. No. Eric, call it the director's cut.
That's about all the questions I have for you, Eric. Feel free to hang out if you like, but let's go ahead and jump on over to Arnie. Arnie, I know you got a bunch of stories for us tonight, so...
Well, I'm going to be real quick because, again, we're running. We want to get to the segment, too, but yes, I have some good stuff. The top of my hit parade this week is The Wonderful World of Linux 2.6, Joseph Pranovich's wonderful account of what's in the new kernel, and he did this the last time with the 2.4, and this is a really in-depth article. It's available in many different languages, and the link is on the Linux World website, and I'm not even gonna begin to discuss that because we'd never get into any further into segment two. This is a really in-depth article describing what the kernel is doing, what the new kernel offers, and some of the decisions that were made along the way. It's a very good article. He did it last time.
And I was hoping we'd have to talk about this, but I'll tell you what. Why don't, to give everybody a chance to take a look at the article, why don't we bring this article back next week? And really what I'd like everybody to do is to take a look at some of the specification on 2.6, and let's talk about a couple of the highlights of what the next kernel is going to do for Linux in terms of reaching into new potential market niches for existing vendors or entrepreneurs.
Or why don't we see if we can get Pranovich in as a guest?
Yeah, very, very possibly. Be a great idea.
Yeah, because he's very knowledgeable and has a way of relating the information to people who aren't so technical. And it's quite a, in spite of it being a very technical topic. The second one is probably all over the IT press is the flaw in Linux kernel allows attack. This is centered on the crack of the Debian project sites just the last few days, I guess it was last week. And this has finally hit the news, and of course all the IT news sources are saying the same thing, and basically, you know, this big splashy headlines that the kernel, Linux kernel, has a bug in it. You know, that allows a crack. Well, these things happen. And I don't think it's as alarming as they make it, but and the damage was pretty much minimal.
Yeah, at least it didn't sweep 10,000 business users or some other extremely large scale.
Did any of the stories point out that there was already a patch for the bug to prevent it?
Yeah,
good.
The bug was fixed, and I don't know. It just says the latest kernel. I'm on CNET News. News.com. It says the latest version of the kernel 2.4.2.3 was released Friday, 8 days after the Debian breach. But it doesn't say. A fix came a bit late, however. Well, I guess they're not reporting that it was already in there. Oh, well.
Yeah, well, the fix came a bit late is one of those in the eye of the beholder things, I guess.
Let's talk about late fixes. We got to talk about Internet Explorer.
Exploder?
Yeah, Exploder. Next one is also from CNET News, and it's just one of the Red Hat executives is moving to Executive Vice President of Sales, Tim Buckley. Tim Buckley is retired. Alex Pinchak leads the international operations for Linux operating system seller, will take over as head of sales. So that's just a new new executive at Red Hat.
Let's talk about the Linux tablet.
Yeah, that's the next one. This is the one I've been wanting to get to. Element Computer, a website which was fully slash-dotted the last 24 hours, has Linux laptops for sale, including an item called the Helium 2100, which is a sub-$1,000 tablet PC. All Element Computer, each one is named after an element of the periodic table. Each machine has a runs Licorice. There are no Windows. They have a no Windows policy, and explicitly state that on their website on just about every page. You can now get there. That's no longer slash dotted. This hit slash dot last night, and boy, you just couldn't get on. They are running BSD, by the way, as they're hosting. This looks like a pretty nice little machine for under $1,000. It's got a touch 1024 by 768 14-inch touch panel display and 1 gigahertz VIA processor, and it's got a flip around display so you can use a stylus on it, and oh, it's got the keyboard. And they've got a couple other laptops, notebooks. Pretty nice looking little systems.
Yeah, the only thing that you can say negative, and it's really not a negative, is it doesn't have Centrino support. And that's about it.
Well, I mean, they're fairly new, maybe, huh? So maybe they're working on some things. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, a lot of that is going to be motivated by continued arm twisting of Intel. It's really not going to come out of these Element folks or Licorice. It's going to be the demand of the market that's going to make Intel get off their ass.
Well, also, you bear in mind, this is a sub-$1,000 notebook.
Yep.
And it's fairly, when you consider its performance and its features, it's a fairly good bargain. And you're just not going to be able to put out an Intel processor-based system for that.
Yep.
Because Intel's a little more money.
Yep. Are you familiar with the Antar processor at all?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm familiar with some of the VIA stuff, but not that particular one.
Yeah, totally familiar with all the VIA chipsets, but I have absolutely zero experience with any of their CPUs, so I'm going to definitely be doing some investigations into this. Everybody's been talking about this Helium 2100 all day long. I'd say, in terms of the personal emails that I've gotten during the course of the day, I'd say one out of four emails I've got was, have you seen this? Have you seen this?
Let's put that company on our list as possible guests.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Really like the excitement that I've done. But I do have a question for you, Arnie. I presume you've gone to their website. Does their website work right?
Yeah, it works right. I'm running Galleon. Let's see, which Mozilla am I
doing?
Galleon 129.
I'm running Mozilla, and I don't know if this is Mozilla or that it's just not a Linux-friendly website.
It's beautiful. Everything's rendering perfectly.
Just that some of the things I'm clicking on, nothing's happening.
Oh, maybe you don't have. I have Java enabled and JavaScript.
Yeah, I have them enabled, too. I was just curious. I can't imagine that anybody who has a no Windows policy on their website could build a non-Linux friendly website. But sillier things have happened.
It actually renders better than many. It's one of the better design. It's basically black and white.
Yep.
It's one of the nicest design, cleanest designs I've seen in a while for an e-commerce website. Now I'm not running it at full screen because my screen is ridiculously large, but it's nice. It's nice, and it all seems to work. They have another one called the Mercury 700, which is a just more traditional notebook computer. That's $800. And then their big notebook is $1,200. It's called the Nitrogen 1000, which is Pentium 4 based. And then there's a Plutonium 1000, which is an all-in-one, and it runs about $1,000. So they have a nice little lineup of machines, at least the four machines in the notebook class.
Okay. Well, other than announcing our Clueless Pundit of the Week award,
yeah, we got two good ones.
I would really like to put the rest of the stories off till next week because it is 45 after the hour and Bruce is queued up waiting to talk to us about user distribution. So we're going to want to get into our break real quick now. But at least in terms of my vote for Clueless Pun of the Week goes to NewsForge submitter Apurva Mehta, a young man from India. I'm going to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. He's only 19 years old. But his article, A Modified License for Free Software Fairness, is so goofy, it is almost laughable. It starts off with the simple fundamental premise that free software is not fair.
Not fair to the developers.
I mean, when you start with that premise, of course his argument sounds reasonable, but it's so silly because if you didn't want to develop free software, no one's sitting there with a gun to your head.
Yeah, I can. You're perfectly free to go work for a company and develop software, and where they end up owning it all.
Yeah, well... Yeah, so the whole premise on the basis of his article, we won't even get into his arguments because they were equally as goofy. But you know, let's take it for what it's worth. He is a young man; he's only 19, doesn't have a lot of experience, so we will forgive him. Arnie, did you have a nomination for Clueless Pun of the Week?
That was one, and I think I'll go with yours. There was another one that one of our listeners sent a link on. And that's I don't have the link now anymore. So let's just stick with this one.
Well, okay. Well, before we cut out on our break and come back with segment number two, I would like to take the opportunity to thank a couple of our listeners who have been following through on one of the requests we made last week, and that request was for people to go out to the Grok Law website and look at the Grok Law quote database and pick a quote or two by our friends from SCO and actually develop some form of an intelligent argument, not just a rant, not just an equally silly spiel, but something that's a really intelligent, fact-based rebuttal to one of these quotes, because I think it's important that as it becomes more and more obvious to the mainstream that SCO is not telling the truth, that we really take the opportunity of the fact that the mind is opening in the rest of the world to present them with sensible arguments, not just things like Darryl should, you know, die. We can't use comments like that and expect them to take us seriously. Or even just say, well, they're all lies. We have to say they're all lies because of some real legitimate thing. And we have gotten really great responses back from a couple of our listeners, and we're going to submit those all in a document to the folks at Grok Law, and they're going to hopefully start up a new section at the Grok Law website. If they don't, we'll just post them at the Linux Show website. But those submissions that we've gotten so far have been extremely detailed. So if you've got some time this coming weekend, go to the Grok Law quote database, do a look up on student Darryl McBride or Chris Sontag, pick a quote, any quote, none of them are true. doesn't matter which one you pick. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. It really is. But just have a little fun over the weekend, do a little research, and come up with a short 4 or 5 paragraph thesis as to why this is all lies. So let's go ahead and take our break. Kick back, listen to the tunes. We'll be right back with segment number two of the Linux Show. December the 2nd, 2003, only a couple more weeks in the year to go. We'll be back in a few minutes with segment number two with Bruce and talking about desktops. So hang in there, everybody. We'll be right back.
And we're back.
It is the Linux Show for December the 2nd, 2003. Here we are at segment number two. And we have as our guest this evening Bruce Perrins, many time guest of the Linux Show, and well-known leader and open source maven, joining us tonight to talk about one of Bruce's new, I don't know what you call it, new little projects that he's involved in, and that is the promotion of the concept of a universal, and I'm putting words in Bruce's mouth, which is not fair. I'll let him do it himself in just a moment. But anyways, in general, it's a universal user distribution. So welcome to the show tonight, Bruce. And can I first start out by asking, what made you think that this needed to be done?
Well, there's a lot of confusion about what I'm trying to do. I've put up a manifesto, which is at userlinux.com. I don't have a userlinux.org at the moment. That's in the hands of some domain squatter, but hopefully people should be able to get to that. And if you look there, the main thing that I'm after is to fix the economic paradigm of the Linux distribution. So what's wrong with the economic paradigm? Well, at its very worst, it created SCO. And at its very best, we have some Linux distributions, which I think you can say are departing from the ethos of open source. I feel that Red Hat's doing that with the entire Enterprise Linux setup. Enterprise Linux is a invitation to be locked in and pay high prices for software that really should be free software. And I think that one of the things we have to realize is that Linux distribution doesn't work very well as a profit center. And you can see that in the fact that Red Hat has really had to get tough with both its own customers and vendors like IBM, HP, etc., just to make a profit. That Caldera got pushed into madness and antisocial behavior, etc. So I think that there is another way to approach the economics of Linux distribution. And that is to resolve that, well, if Linux distribution doesn't work so well as a profit center, how about as a cost-sharing exercise? And that relies on something that's different today than what it used to be. Today we have a lot of people whose businesses depend on Linux. This is not the early adopter stage anymore. And thus, I have had groups of very large companies come to contact me and say, we would be interested in paying for the engineering of a Linux distribution which would be free per unit in terms of free beer. No additional per seat cost for adding a seat. And we would pay for the engineering of this, and we would pay for support incidents. But what we don't want to do is pay a per seat cost, especially the very high per seat costs that we're seeing today. And that industry group is actually talking about a investment of somewhere north of $1 million per year to serve their needs.
And that could be shared across any number of industries.
Yeah, so in this case, there's a group of some number of companies. They represent 50,000 server and workstation seats. And if they're willing to put in $1 million or a little more, you figure that they're actually paying about $20 per seat. So the savings would be fantastic for them over one of the various enterprise Linux systems that are out today. The fact is, this is only one industry group. They're extremely specialized, and there are a lot of other industries that depend on Linux and that would be either willing to contribute resources, people, time, bandwidths, etc., or money. So I think we have the chance to put together a consortium, really, of various business users, even individuals. I think I have a good way to handle individual participants who would support the development of a Linux system that was both free beer and free software, and who would pay for service on that. Now, we don't want lock-in, so how do you service it? What I'm proposing is that there be multiple service vendors who would each do service and engineering on this central Linux distribution, which would itself be a nonprofit, and they would be paid to do service and engineering by their various customers who want a change in the system, who want something supported, etc. So it won't surprise you that I'm proposing to build this around Debian.
It's certainly free as in beer.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, take a good look at Fedora. The news has not been good. We just saw the second Fedora leadership draft posted today, and let me read you something out of it. I'm actually surprised it wasn't on your news list. The Fedora leadership structure is not a voting structure. They're asking for a benevolent oligarchy, and they say it's not their experience that voting works in Linux and open source. And the other thing was they wanted to keep control in the hands of Red Hat. So right now they've got a steering committee, which is five Red Hat employees. Michael K. Johnson is leading it. You can get to this through LWN if you want. And the steering committee reports directly to Red Hat management. And the problem that I have is, well, gee, you know, we, the free software community, are going to make Red Hat for Red Hat. We're going to do this by participating on Fedora. And then Red Hat will take all of the standards organization certifications, the vendor support, the fact that Oracle says it's good, which means a lot to a lot of business customers, and they will hold that back not for the Fedora that we would work on, but only for the expensive Red Hat Enterprise Linux product. And that just seems to me to be an extremely unequal partnership. So I set out to see if I could define a partnership that was much more equal and that would work for everyone.
Well, first of all, I'd like to start out, if I may, and Bruce, please understand that you and I are friends, and I'm not meaning to beat up on you.
Oh, but those who are not for us are against us, don't you know that?
But I really, you know, first of all, I challenge, what's the best way to put this? I'm not so sure as the premise on which a lot of this is based is a valid premise.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why I'm saying that is we keep on looking at the historical context of the last, 24 or 30 months, and somehow think that this is evidence of the failure of open technology, and in particular, an open source operating system, and I don't buy that argument at all. I understand your evidence pointing at Red Hat. And I understand your evidence pointing at Caldera, but I think there are a hell of a lot more significant other causes to these company's problems than the fact that they're selling an open source product. I can go back to the simplest thing I can think of, and that is that there are tons of companies out there that are selling bottled water for $2.50 for an 8-ounce bottle of water. I think the problem that these companies have had is, number one, the general turndown in the economy, and number two, we've had a significant IT recession. And the Linux/open source community is far from immune to what has happened to the rest of the IT world. And
that point I have to differ with. Okay, Linux and open source have not had an IT recession. If anything, the IT recession has caused people to turn to us who were previously using Unix systems on underperforming hardware. And the fact is I run a company that does only service related to Linux and open source software, designs for other companies. I do public speaking, etc., and business is up. And so I don't think we can really blame this on the fact that the economy is sour. I think that, however, we have to look at where we started as a free software community. And obviously, we intended for business to be a partner in this, but we did not intend for free software to march to the tune of the needs of its vendors. If anything, we wanted it to march to the tune of the needs of its customers. And I think that the problem that we're having right now is that we have tied our success or failure to the success or failure of businesses who frankly have extremely marginal business plans. And I think that we do contribute to making them marginal. And what I would like to see is, you know, let's not have a Linux roll-up, which is what's sort of happening now, where we end up with one or possibly two strong vendors. So if it's not a monopoly, it'll be a duopoly. Who have pretty much cornered the market on free software. I think that if we get to that point, we've created another Microsoft, and why the heck did we do all this work just to do that? One of the fundamental elements in free software is the potential to circumvent. If you don't like what Red Hat is doing, you have the ability to go around them, to circumvent them, because you have the same rights on the software as they do. And that is the market correction mechanism in open source software.
Yes, and it works.
And I think the problem right now is we have a couple things that distort the economic picture. And one of the very largest happens to be Oracle. Oracle has tremendous power to make a Linux distribution acceptable or not just by saying, we support it on Oracle. And it's actually kind of ludicrous because 99% of these systems don't run Oracle. What happens is that they have one or two Oracle servers in the house. And if they're going to get Linux, they just don't want to have to know more than one. So they'll get the Oracle-certified Linux, run it on all the desktops besides the servers, and obviously pay too much. So I think that one of the things that we need to do is get the customers organized as part of this development so that instead of the vendor, like an Oracle, calling the shots and saying, here, this is what you can run. If we have an organized group of customers, they can say, here, this is what we want, with the power to make an application vendor listen. And I think that that way we can go back to what we used to have, which was you can copy Linux and put it on another workstation and go and run it and get support for it, and that's okay. If you look at the Advanced Server Agreement today, you'll find that if you copy the support information, if you copy their service bulletins and pass them on to somebody who's not a member, they will withdraw your support contract. Frankly, I don't want to see people doing that with software that I wrote.
What's interesting about that is that there's still competition in the Linux distribution field, in spite of the fact that there's vendors doing various things, but these complaints should work themselves out in the marketplace. But I still, by the same token, understand what you're saying, Bruce, and understand, and I fully think that there is a clear market because of the advances in IT recently, and in the business seems to be getting back together again. And I really think this is a really, really opportune time to break with something like this.
I think I don't know if everyone thinks of it this way, but the recent announcements by Red Hat I saw as sort of an abdication. And I saw that they left a wide open market.
Can I jump in here, because I'm going to have to leave soon? And
sure.
That's a really good point. I saw it that way totally. And what I heard, and admittedly it's not from a huge number so far, but you know, I've been hearing that a lot of these enterprises have been using Debian anyway. You know, I mean, I saw it as an immediate.
So let's get them out of the closet.
Yeah, get them out of the closet. I mean, Fedora. I mean, on a branding level, Red Hat shot itself in the head. Forgive me, Red Hat friends, but you know, Red Hat became a silo vendor of vertical solutions that wasn't a whole lot different than what anybody else is doing. It looks to me like they're configured for acquisition by Oracle.
It was the Novell of Linux.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really good way of putting it, the Novell of Linux. In the meantime, Novell's sort of trying to move in another direction. But as soon as they debranded their participation in the community, or rebranded it as Fedora, and as you pointed out, Bruce, you know, still managed to keep its ties with the corporate mothership, it just started looking real weird. And
doesn't Fedora look to you like a copy of Debian, sort of?
Well, that's another thing of yours. Well, but you know, of course, the package management is different, and that.
Yeah, but
matters,
you know, here's a community distribution that does everything that Debian does, starting 10 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well,
it's like they have got a lot to build, just reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't talked too much with Ian Murdoch about this. He'd be a good guy to have on the show, because I think it made him a happy man. Like you, he's in the consulting business too, and in the aftermarket for his own software. And that, you know, Debian is wide open Linux, Red Hat Enterprise Linux is closed end Linux, and you know, the fact that you can build a closed end Linux is fine, I suppose, but. And there will be a market for that. I mean, there are people that are used to paying an awful lot of money for Eudora, for Oracle, and for those guys, you know, Red Hat is just something that's bundled with it, and they don't really care. I don't think beyond a certain point, but the whole market just opened wide. I think it just opened the market completely and changed the whole game. I think it is time to go back and revisit what we were trying to do in the first place, and you know, because I think the customers are doing that anyway. I mean, the customers are very utilitarian.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the event that first pissed me off, and that is, I was talking with someone from HSBC. You know what that is? It's a multinational bank. They're everywhere.
Okay.
And they were considering a 10,000-seat Linux deployment, and they called it off, and the reason they called it off was they said that Linux was now more expensive than Windows, and they were going by the then price for the Red Hat supported product, which is maybe about a fifth of the price now. And I had said to them at the time, well, this is an entirely false perception, because you can still get this software for free, but they could not get the software for free in a state with a brand that they felt secure about, a development and service organization that they felt would be there for them, the support of their own vendors, and
yeah, because they wanted a vendor, and
yeah,
and they're out of step. You know,
well,
what I'm hearing more and more is companies on the customer side are saying, you know, maybe we can live without the vendor.
Well, I think what this tells us, software developers,
Microsoft for a decade now, so
yeah,
they can live without the vendor.
Yeah, but what this tells us, the free software developers, that we expected the commercial Linux distribution, they're not quite that bad, to solve a problem for us. And I don't think they've solved the problem, and it's time for us to step up and try another way to solve it.
I like your idea. I've always seen the software industry as a service industry anyway, and you know, if the community peer-reviewed development certainly makes it that way. What Red Hat has done recently seems to be saying, okay, all right, all this time we've been talking about this being a service industry, and we're saying that now, no, really, it's a software. Software is a product, and we can sell it. And, of course, that's everything that we know is by the way we've worked together this last 10 years, we know that that may not be true.
Yeah.
And this says, okay, let's go back to the roots. And, yeah, this is a service industry. And, no, software isn't a product. It's a service. And, you know, who wants to buy it? Okay, what's the value of Microsoft Windows 3.1 now? It doesn't have a value.
Mm-hmm.
And it never will again.
Well, value is a perceived thing, and it is defined by market.
I know that, but there's
and
no market for it. You know?
And
I mean,
it is yet to be proven one way or the other if it is indeed true or not that software has no value in terms of a sellable product.
Well, I mean, look at the commercial market. Companies who install software on computers do not do it without support. Try to sell software without support, and you'll find out really quickly the extent to which it is a service industry.
Oh yes, the profitability is dismal. I have no argument with you there, Arnie. None at all.
No, I'm not talking about that. You won't be able to sell it. Companies don't want the product. They want the service, period.
Yep. And you can still sell something that's free. And my favorite line of Don Marty's is, information wants to be $6.95. I mean, it's commoditized, and there's nothing wrong with commodities.
That's right.
And we're making a commodity here.
I agree. And see, I think that's where the line that we're dancing around is the fact that it's not the fact that it doesn't have value, it's that value has become a commodity.
Yeah.
And I think that is the key issue.
And the value, the commodity value of that is insignificant next to the value of the support, because the support is what makes the thing work.
Yes. Commodities.
Well, support and engineering.
Commodities.
That's it.
Commodities breed innovation in the market.
There you go.
Okay. And so now I really don't have any objection to what you're doing, Bruce. Don't get me wrong on this. I just think that the potential exists for you to get blown out of the water by a 12-year-old in a garage somewhere.
Why?
Well, because of the fact that it's open source.
So I don't understand. How are you proposing that I be blown out of the water?
A 12-year-old is not going to have the support of of any big industry people like. The idea is to put together the consortium, right? Right, Bruce?
Okay.
You're taking the basis that only big can be good. And that's just not true. We've learned in IT over and over and over again that there are 12-year-olds in garages all over this country that innovate.
And I've got a place for them. The point of this is I am not trying to start the user Linux company. What I'm trying to do is create a structure where there's a nonprofit in the middle and any number of service companies around that nonprofit that compete with each other to get customers and provide engineering services and support for this central Linux distribution that they work on in common. Now, this actually places economic limits on the service companies. And the way to explain that is you can say you can make a living as one of these service companies, but you can't make a killing because everybody else on the playing field has the capability of doing the same things that you can do, and you don't have a lock-in play. So what happens with the 12-year-old? He comes in, establishes himself as an engineering provider. I'm assuming a 12-year-old would rather do engineering than phone support. And gets some good contracts and does some good engineering. Does that hurt?
Does that hurt? I like it.
I'm going to have to see the actual structure of the way the thing works out.
Did you read the manifesto yet?
I started to. And no offense, but I'm really bugged by the name manifesto. Anytime I hear the name manifesto, it just bugs me.
Well, you know, Ian called it a manifesto when he first proposed Debian.
Yeah, and,
so I figured I was following in that tradition.
Yeah.
And of course... I put on my red suit for this.
Yes. as a side question to you, are you familiar with what Lycoris has done with the Debian distribution?
No. And I should be, because Lycoris is in the Desktop Linux Consortium, which I'm supposed to be the executive director of.
Okay. Cause, see, that's what I was getting at, is we have already... an open source, desktop-specific Linux distribution that is basically free with a $29 service contract, unlimited upgrades, and
Debian-based.
And it's Debian-based.
So what
it's successful. It's successful.
And so what I'm doing is I'm proposing to create 100 companies that do what Lycoris does and create them all over the world and for all kinds of specialties. I mean, I'm sure that there will be one who caters to dentists and doesn't do anything else. The problem with just saying, well, let's all focus on Lycoris, look, is that that won't work. That does not create the kind of structure large enough to fulfill the need that a Red Hat or a SUSE was formerly fulfilling.
Oh no, I agree with you. The success of this kind of a development process is going to be to get people to become niche focused. And to a degree, Lycoris has become niche-focused. They have identified a fairly narrow market niche. Your typical Linux user is not particularly happy with Lycoris.
Uh-huh.
because of a cosmetic issue. LaCouris specifically designed it to look like the Windows XP desktop.
Big whoop.
No, well, from a standpoint of trying to get grandmas to use it, this has become extremely successful.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it. If you want to theme it to look like Windows, well, yes, somebody out in the world will curl his lip, but not me.
Yeah. But I think that this is a bunch of very young men who I think have done a superlative job of putting together small niche-based user distribution.
Yeah.
I think it's a model you can follow.
Uh-huh. And what I'm proposing here, there are a number of companies like this. If I can list the ones I know of, probably the most interesting is School of Linux. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so that's a European project to do a Debian for schools.
Yep.
Progeny is doing Debian derivatives where they crank them out for different customers almost automatically. They give their tool a bunch of parameters and it cranks out a derivative Debian distribution. I kid you not. I have to say I'm a little prejudiced. I still own a piece of that company, although I have nothing to do with its management today. Zandros is still alive. That's the old Corel Linux.
That's right.
And
which was Debian-based as well.
Yeah, and indeed Zandros has some real money now because they just sold Zimian out of the other Linux capital company. The one that was more successful than mine. And those guys own Zandros as well. I think their original investment in Zimian was about $5 million. They sold it for $50 million. And then Nopix. Klaus Knopper seems to be doing a great job, and I'd actually like to see some of his work integrated back into the main Debian. There's a Nopix spinoff called Morphix. There's LibreNet, which I hear has a dedicated following as well. There's LaCouris, and finally Lindos, which may damn itself through its arrogance, but otherwise seems to be a good Debian derivative as well. So there are already the seed of these companies surrounding the nonprofit, and I think that all of the ones that I've mentioned are really a natural to go into the structure that I've talked about and start bidding on support and service on that central distribution.
We're going to see some of these. I think we're going to see one or more of these bootable CD distributions going into a more traditional.
Okay,
because the one thing they've got is the hardware detection tools that those bootable CDs do is really the best.
Okay, I like the hardware detection tools. The reason I've turned Flame on is that people are too darn concerned with installation. You install a system once, and then you know what? You use the system.
Yeah.
And I read too many distribution reviews that focus on installation.
Oh, if it doesn't have a graphical user interface, they sit there wringing their hands.
Yeah, and that's just stupid.
Yeah, who wants who wants eye candy for something you do once?
Yeah, and we have to grow up a bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nopix is an ideal product for the thin client environment, that type of a product.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And we're going to see at Linux World a lot of Linux thin clients. In fact, if you stop in the Desktop Linux Consortium booth, you'll see quite a few of them.
Yep, no doubt.
Yeah.
The day's come.
Yeah, I'm seeing the plans for the show coming up. DLC is going to have a very big booth and a lot of interesting things happening in it.
Well, we are 30 past the hour here in Chicago, so we're going to have to call it an evening. Bruce, it was really good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
I'm still only 98% sold. I'm a diehard entrepreneur-based person.
Well, why don't you just let it wait a couple of years and I'll show you?
Yeah, well, we'll see. You know,
yeah.
I believe things come from the bottom up that are good, and we'll see if it does indeed work out that way. So, you know, I'm certainly not going to. I'm not going to damn your effort, because one of the great things about the open source community is that it is open. It does give the opportunity for lots of different things to be tried lots of different ways, and some will succeed, some won't. And so that's the beauty of what we're doing here is it is so open and promotes so much innovation. Something that we're doing is going to end up working over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, Bruce, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
It was enjoyable to have you on the show again. For all of those of you out there listening, again, thanks for stopping by to this week's Linux Show. Make sure you tell your friends all about the show. Stop by and visit our website, especially during the course of the next couple of weeks. We are going to be posting up our holiday schedule very shortly. We will not be having shows every week during the month of December. We'll probably take at least 1 week off this month and probably the first week of January, the way it's shaping up right now. But keep an eye out. We will put together a best of show here and there, and we're also going to put together our annual year in review show that we'll have posted up on the site sometime fairly soon. But until next time, check us out. Thanks for stopping by. This has been the Linux Show for Tuesday, the 2nd of December 2003. We are out of here.